Crawford in your email to stand@crawfordbroadcasting.com. Tell him on what station you hear his commentaries when you write to stand@crawfordbroadcasting.com. And visit the Stand page at www.crawfordbroadcasting.com when you want to read and print commentaries. I'm Bill McCormick.
Cave Right.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, this station, or its sponsors.
Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for a half hour in the morning. We're actually live for an hour in the afternoon. I do two programs a day. The morning program is a half hour and the afternoon program is an hour. These programs are not all heard on the same stations. If you're listening to the morning program, we only broadcast really in Southern California. If you want to hear the afternoon program, we only broadcast outside Southern California, but both broadcasts can be heard, can be listened to, streamed from our website, and archived there, so you can go back and listen to programs from many years of our program. I think we're archived back to 2006, although the program's been on the air since 1997, and we're on every day opening our phone lines for you to call if you have questions about the Bible. And you can call them right now, but we only have a half hour in the morning. So you want to call as early as you can, and we can talk to you about them. The number is 800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. Our first caller today is Rod, who's calling from Riverside, California. Rod, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Brother Steve. Pertain to your particular position on replacement theology.
Okay. That's the question? What is
Yes.
my position on it? Okay. Well, my position is on replacement theology is that replacement theology is not a proper name for any doctrine that I'm aware of. There is a doctrine called supersessionism, which its own adherents might call it, they don't call it replacement theology. They call it remnant theology or fulfillment theology. But its enemies call it replacement theology. Okay, so those who don't like this doctrine call it replacement theology, and they say that the doctrine replaces Israel with the church. And while perhaps one could put it that way, that's not really the way that the doctrine is understands things. You see, people who criticize replacement theology usually are thinking in terms like these, that in the Old Testament there was the nation of Israel, ethnic Israel, the Jews, and they were God's chosen people. But in the New Testament, replacement theologians say that the Jewish race is now rejected, and that now there's the Gentile church that has replaced it. This is how sometimes people think about replacement theology. That's not really what replacement theology or remnant theology or fulfillment theology or supersessionism really teaches at all. There never was a time when all the Jews in the Old Testament were God's people. Only those who kept the covenant were. Others were cut off from the people, the Bible says. There never was a time when there were no Gentiles among God's people, because even in Israel in the Old Testament there were Gentiles like Rahab and like Ruth, who became Jews, and they were Gentiles by birth. So even in the Old Testament there never was a time when it was just, you know, the people who are Jewish are God's people and the people who are Gentiles are not. It's rather the people who are joined to God through his covenant were God's people. And that's still true. And it says in Jeremiah 31 that God would make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, which means that the covenant that they would be joined to would be a new covenant, not the old one. The old one was made at Mount Sinai. The new one was made in the upper room by Jesus Christ with his disciples, who were the remnant, the believers of Israel, who believed in him. So he established the new covenant, and it superseded the old covenant. That is to say, when there's a new covenant, the old covenant's done. And therefore, people were considered to be God's people. They were considered to be Israel in the old covenant if they were loyal to the old covenant. And that didn't matter whether they were Jewish or Gentile by birth. If they were loyal to the covenant, they were Israel. The same is true now with the new covenant. If people are loyal to the new covenant, it doesn't matter if they're Jewish or Gentile. There are both. There are Jews and Gentiles who are loyal to the new covenant. And they are the true Israel, same as in the Old Testament. The only difference is the new covenant has replaced the old covenant. And I believe that's biblical. Now, that's what people believe who are accused of being replacement theologians. But you see, there's nothing really replaced except the covenant. It's not as if God replaced the Jews with Gentiles or something like that. It's rather, he replaced an old covenant with one that was a better covenant. And so he's stepped up. He's improved things. A better covenant based on better promises, it says in Hebrews chapter 10. So that's what I think about it.
That's very interesting, Steve. I sure appreciate your viewpoints on a lot of things. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rod. Thanks for calling today. Good talking to you. Okay, our next caller. By the way, we had four callers online. All their names start with R. That was Rod. We have Roy, Ron, and Randy also waiting. Roy is next in line, I think, and so welcome to the Narrow Path from San Diego.
Thank
Hi,
you.
Roy.
Hi. Hi, Ray. Hey,
hello.
Greg, can you hear me? Hello.
Well, I can hear you if you talk directly into your phone. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you good. Real good.
Okay. Okay. So what are you calling about?
I hear you say things about apologists. And that means there must be non-apologists. What's the difference?
Well, I'm not sure what you think an apologist is. There's apologetics is a field of study, and it is a study of evidences. The word apologetics comes from the Greek word apologia, which means a defense. So somebody who studies how to defend a viewpoint would be an apologist, somebody who's learned how to defend their viewpoint. If they're a Christian apologist, that means that they have learned how to defend Christianity. Now, a person doesn't have to study formally. Anyone who makes a defense for their faith is, at that moment, an apologist for their position. And that's true even if they're not Christians. A person could be an apologist for atheism, or an apologist for the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or for something else. Somebody who's giving a defense, if someone's giving a defense of their position, they are engaged in apologetics, and that makes them, at that moment, an apologist.
Oh, okay. So apologist is agreeing that what you believe is right?
Well, no, an apologist is a person who defends his beliefs. That's what an apologist is, someone who defends his beliefs. Well, whatever his beliefs may be.
Isn't everybody an apologist, or do they? Is there?
Well, everyone should be. Everyone should be, because the word apologist comes from apologia, and apologia is found in 1 Peter 3:15, where Peter says that we should be prepared to give everyone an answer and a reason of the hope that is in us, in meekness and fear. So everyone should be able to give an apology or an apologia. A defense for their faith. So, yeah, every Christian ought to be, at some level, an apologist, yes.
Can I ask you one fast, more question? I just want to know, do you believe that we're going to be taken out of the world before the Great Tribulation comes?
No.
We're going to be in the world when it happens, right?
I believe the Great Tribulation occurred in the past. And I don't think there's anything in the Bible that speaks specifically of a future, specific time called the Tribulation.
What do you mean? You mean they already went through the tribulations?
Well, the tribulation is mentioned in two places in the Bible. It's mentioned in Matthew 24, verse 21. And it's mentioned in Revelation 7:14. In Matthew 24:21, Jesus said, "Then there shall be great tribulation such as never was since the world began, nor ever shall be." A few verses later he said, "And this generation will not pass before all these things take place." So Jesus said that the great tribulation that he spoke about would happen within that generation. Now the only other place that mentions a great tribulation is Revelation 7:14. Where it says, "These are those who are coming up," present tense, "out of the great tribulation and have washed their garments and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." And so John sees people who are coming up, present tense, in his time, from the great tribulation. Now, the book of Revelation itself tells its readers many times that the things that were written in it were about to take place, and that the time was near. So just like Jesus said that the tribulation period he spoke of would happen in that generation, the book of Revelation says that the tribulation it speaks of was near also at the time of writing. So if both Jesus spoke in 30 AD, and the book of Revelation was written sometime, obviously, in the first century, both of them said that the tribulation was near. And I believe that it was. And Jesus specifically said it would be in that generation, and I think it was. So that's why I don't think it's future. I mean, this has been 2,000 years since then. And so I don't know of any reference in the Bible to an end times tribulation.
What are we waiting for then? Only the coming of Christ?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't there tribulation on the world today?
Oh, yeah, there's tribulation all the time. Jesus said to his disciples, "In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." So, yeah, we all have tribulation. But you were asking about a future tribulation. I think you were talking about the tribulation. And I was saying that event is spoken of twice in Scripture, and both places say it would happen in the first century or very soon after it was predicted. Paul told the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 3:4, he said, "For in fact, we told you before when we were with you that you would suffer tribulation, just as it has happened, and you know." So Jesus told his disciples, "In the world you will have tribulation." Mm-hmm. Paul told the Thessalonians, "I told you that you would suffer tribulation, and it has happened." So, the tribulation, if we're talking about the tribulation, Jesus seems to be talking about the tribulation that came upon the Jews in the Jewish war when the Romans attacked and slaughtered them. But tribulation is a generic term also just for, literally in the Greek, philipsis, tribulation means pressure. So, yeah, there's pressure. Christians are under pressure all the time.
Yeah. Okay, Greg.
All right.
Thank you very much for your answers. Have a nice day.
Thank you for your call. Thank you. You have a nice day, too. All right. This is going to be next, Ron from San Diego. Ron, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve. God bless you. How do you reconcile what the gospel
Just a minute, Ron. Are you using a speakerphone? Hello? Do you have a speakerphone?
I am.
Could you use your regular phone? Because we're on the radio and we need to have good quality, okay?
Is that better?
I think it is, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. How do you reconcile the differences in the gospel? Some places it says stay in Jerusalem, and the other places I'll see you in Galilee.
Well, I believe that Jesus, during his lifetime, both before and after his resurrection, made trips between Galilee and Jerusalem. And he first appeared to his disciples, the 12, and to the women in Jerusalem the day of his resurrection, and then a week later, also when Thomas was there, they were still in Jerusalem, it would appear. However, he did say that he's going to meet his disciples in Galilee, and so he did, apparently. It says in Matthew chapter 28 that he met them on a hill or on a mountain in Galilee, and he gave them some commission. And also we read of them fishing in Galilee in John chapter 21 up there after the resurrection. So clearly they went up to Galilee as well. But then they came back down to Jerusalem, probably because of Pentecost. Excuse me. Because they had it was Passover when Jesus died and rose again. So they were in Jerusalem for the feast. They apparently went up to Galilee, which is where their home was after that. But they came back down to Jerusalem for Pentecost. And they came down 10 days early of Pentecost. And that's where Jesus gave them again the commission, and he ascended from the Mount of Olives. And then 10 days later, the day of Pentecost occurred. So I don't really see a problem. You have to realize Israel is a pretty small country. It's about 70 miles, I think, from Galilee to Jerusalem. So traveling that far was not uncommon for people. It took a while, of course, on foot, but it still was commonly done. And so I think the disciples and Jesus were in Jerusalem twice after his resurrection and in Galilee in between.
Okay. That makes sense. Thank you.
Okay, Ron. Thanks for your call. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Randy, calling from Redlands, California. And if you'd like to be on the program, we have some lines open now for you and a little bit of time left. The number is 800-227-5278. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. You can be on the program if you call soon. 800-227-5278. Excuse me. Randy, welcome to The Narrow Path. I thank you for calling today.
Thanks for taking my call. Yesterday you had a caller who, in passing, mentioned that he didn't believe there was any evidence for the soul found in Scripture and that its origin was pagan. And I was wondering if you might comment on that, if there's any validity to that statement. It seems to me that you find plenty of information there about the soul.
Okay, well, there is some ambiguity about the soul, because the word that's translated soul in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word, is nephesh. And that word doesn't refer to a non-material soul, per se, although it can. I mean, it's not like it couldn't ever refer to that, but most of the time, nephesh seems to simply refer to the whole person. So, you know, God made man from the dust of the earth and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. That is, his body and the breath altogether became a soul. And in that sense, every human being is a soul, but it's hard to prove anything about a non-material soul. From the Old Testament, use the word nephesh. Now, in the New Testament, the Greek word is pneuma. Excuse me, there's a P at the beginning of that, pneuma. And some would pronounce it and some would not. But pneuma is also translated soul or life sometimes in the New Testament. And it does sound like it sometimes speaks of something different than the body. That is to say, a non-material part, because Paul talked about God sanctifying you in your soul and your spirit and your body. So your body is one thing, and your soul and your spirit are something else. also in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 12, it says that the word of God is sharp, like a two-edged sword, divides between the soul and the spirit and the joints and the marrow. Well, the joints and the marrow would certainly be the body. The soul and the spirit seem to be something else. So the Bible does seem to teach there's a soul as well as a body. Paul said, though our outward man is perishing, our inward man is being renewed day by day. Now, there he doesn't even use the word soul, but he talks about our outward physical self and our inward self, which is contrasted from that. Besides that, Paul talks at times about the possibility of being absent from the body. For example, when he said that he knew a man who was caught up into the third heaven in 2 Corinthians 12, he said, whether that was in the body or out of the body, I don't know. He says, only God knows that. Which means that Paul believed it was at least a possibility that the man was out of his body. But if a man is out of his body, what is that man? He's not in his body. He's not his body. He's something else. So the Bible does give some evidence, in the New Testament mostly, for there being a non-material something, soul, spirit, or something. And I believe that's true. Now the thing is that wasn't really brought out much in the Old Testament. And so many people think that it came into Christianity through the Greek world, because the Greeks always had a strong emphasis on the soul. The Greeks believed that all things physical are evil and all things spiritual are good. So the body, they thought, was an evil thing. And the spirit of man was the good part of him, and that when he died, the spirit left the body. They believed that during this lifetime, the spirit was enslaved in the body or imprisoned in the body. And so this is a Greek idea from the Greek philosophers. And so when we find this taught in the church, some people say the church got it from the Greek philosophers, from paganism. But in my opinion, it's found in the New Testament. And just because pagans happened to believe that there was a non-material side of man doesn't mean they were wrong. The Old Testament doesn't deny it. Nothing in the Bible denies it. And frankly, it would seem to me that thoughtful people would suspect that anyway. You know, I mean, anyone who's philosophically inclined, like the Greeks were, has got to think deeper and say, well, there's something more to me than just this body. Certainly when a person dies and you see their dead body, there's something gone from there. It's not just the heartbeat. There's something different there. Anyone who's been around dead bodies knows, hey, that's not the person I knew. And so I would think that contemplative and philosophically oriented people, as the Greeks were, would come up with the soul idea on their own, even if it's something true. I think probably most societies would come up with a belief in a non-material soul, because I think it's hard to deny it. But there are some who do deny it. But I don't think it came into the church through paganism. I think it came into the church through the New Testament.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's difficult if you get rid of the idea of the spirit man at all. You have some problems with a lot of threading together what makes sense of spiritual renewal, any sorts of things. Plus, Christ himself says, you know, not sure those who can kill the body cannot kill the soul. So I don't know why some people want to say that this is a pagan idea. I just understand what appeal that would have to them to deny any of this. In fact, it would cause a lot of problems. So. But I think you've kind of spelled
it out. People who say that, a lot of times they're trying to prove a doctrine called soul sleep. And that is the view that when people die, they go dark. They go unconscious. There's no consciousness. There's no further existence until the end of the world when the resurrection takes place. So that between the time you die and the time you rise from the dead on the last day, you're simply non-existent. You're gone somewhere. There's no consciousness. Now, a more traditional view held by most Christians is that when you die, your spirit goes consciously to be in the presence of God until the resurrection. At the resurrection, God raises our bodies again. But until then, our soul is separated from our body at death. And if we're Christians, we are with the Lord. Now, that's the more traditional view and more widely held, and I hold it myself, and I think Paul did. But there are some who believe that we should see death as passing out of consciousness until the resurrection. And this idea would be amenable with the idea that the body is all we have, and that our thoughts and our attitudes and our personality are just generated from the physical organ called the brain. You know, and that, of course, that's what naturalists and atheists believe, too. However, those who believe in soul sleep are not by any means atheists or naturalists. It's just their doctrine. But the people who aren't believers in God at all or in the spiritual realm, they would say that our personalities and our thoughts and our opinions and all that are simply generated from the interaction of the neurons of our brain. They're just electrical charges. Of course, what they never really apparently think deeply about is that would mean that nothing that we think or feel is valid in itself. That is, there's no external validity to our thoughts, and they're just what the laws of nature play. It's sort of like I have no control over the process of my heartbeat, because that's just done by natural processes. So also the thoughts emanating from my brain would simply be the result of natural processes I have no control over. And therefore, my thought, and by the way, a lot of atheists have and naturalists have said this is what they really believe, that a person is really not responsible for what they do because they don't have any free will. All of our thoughts and actions come from simply the natural laws playing on the neurons of our brain. Well, if people want to believe that, I guess they can, but I don't think the evidence is favorable, and I don't think it makes for a better society either. I think that for people to be held responsible for choosing right and rejecting wrong and doing good instead of doing evil is not only good for society, I think there's a transcendent reality to that. But if it's just my brain generating everything that comes out of it, then it's just a physical organ, just like my liver or my kidney or my heart or my lung. And therefore, what it produces is no more, you know, significant than the gall that's produced out of my gallbladder. You know, I mean, thoughts and ideas emanate from the physical action of the brain on this view, just like, you know, secretions emanate from certain glands in your body. So obviously that would mean my thoughts don't have any particular validity. But it would also mean that the thoughts of those people who are saying those things don't have any validity either.
Well, thank you for answering that question. Yeah, it just seems, just what you mentioned here, would add even further problems with denying the existence of a soulish state. So anyways, thank you so much, Steve, for considering this.
Okay, Randy, thank you for your call. Good talking to you. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. You know, the Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and there's no expenses except for the cost of radio time, really. I mean, a few incidental things. We pay, you know, for paper for the printers and things like that, but there's very, very little over it, almost none at all. In fact, much of those kinds of expenses come out of my pocket or the pocket of other volunteers. We have only volunteers in this ministry. We don't have any paid persons here. So, and we don't have any offices or anything like that. So there's really no overhead. This is the leanest ministry you'll ever find, I think. You give money to the Narrow Path, it doesn't come to us, it goes to the radio stations, and then it goes out over the air to people who can hear the program. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, we buy this radio time from various radio stations. This morning program is being broadcast only in Southern California on KBRT, but our afternoon show is on many radio stations around the country. And all these stations are reaching different groups of people. And if this show has had an impact on you, you might assume that it's had an impact on other people too, and that it might be, if it's a good impact, that it might be good to keep it on the air and maybe even expand it to other radio areas. If you're interested in supporting this ministry's expansion and or even its survival on this station, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's the address you can mail to, or if you want to donate, you can go to our website. Everything at the website is free, including archived radio programs, tons of Bible lectures, printed material. Everything's free there. Lots of resources of value at thenarrowpath.com. You also have the opportunity to donate from there if you want to at thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Hope you'll tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion. God bless you.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of KBRT, its ownership, its management, or its sponsors.
You are tuned in to KBRT AM 740 and AM 1240 San Diego, serving God and country. I want you to go to our Facebook page, search KBRT, 8 Reasons the Worship Industry is Killing Worship. It's kind of scary how much truth is in this article. Make sure you read it. And coming up next is Enjoying Everyday Life with Joyce Meyer. So stay right here on KBRT. I'm Rob Newton.
We encourage our San Diego family to take part in LifeWalk. It's the family-friendly, fun 5K run or walk event coming up on October 24th at De Anza Cove in Mission Valley. For you, it's an exciting, family-friendly time of music, activities, and entertainment. But the annual 5K LifeWalk also raises funds for Life Perspectives and their healing outreach called Abortion Changes You. It focuses on creating a safe place for hurting men and women who've been touched by an abortion to begin the healing process. In addition, Abortion Changes You provides training to churches, pregnancy centers, and therapists, both locally and nationally.
Through LifeWalk, you'll take part in a one-day celebration of life that brings hope and healing to hurting men and women around the globe, as well as supporting life perspectives in their vital ministry. K-Bright will be there, and we hope you will be there too. Register to participate at lplifewalk.com and share with your friends through all your social networks. That's lplifewalk.com.
More than 30 years of sharing the good news. KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa and KNSN San Diego. Also on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled, How to Survive Change. Are you waiting for a life-changing experience from God? It's good to want and even seek after God for a change in your life, but it can also be discouraging when you've been waiting and searching for a long time with no results to show for it. Remember that the road to change is more of a journey than a race. You won't wake up one day and feel different, but as you seek God through daily study and prayer, He will reveal Himself to you and help transform you into the person He wants you to be. So how do you survive this process of change? Hear from Joyce next as she shares some of her own lessons that God taught her on change and also offers some wisdom and encouragement for your own journey. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, How to Survive Change.
In teaching